Well, thank you, and I'm going to be the only speaker today talking about a non-HIV topic, but also I have to say, borrowing from it and symbolism that Dr. Hillier referred to, we actually have a holy grail for HPV, and vaccines are the holy grail, and we do have one. Since HPV vaccine first emerged as a potential public health prevention measure, the vaccine has created both great enthusiasm but also great suspicion. It's been hailed as a cancer prevention tool, and this is not technically correct because I think, as most of you know, hepatitis B vaccine was the first cancer vaccine, but it makes a good headline nonetheless. And it's also been raised as something that might promote risky sexual behavior. This morning I'm going to talk about four areas, and I'm going to first talk about some background and then talk about the U.S. vaccination program and touch a little bit on how this enthusiasm and the suspicion has played out, then talk about HPV vaccines and some policy issues, and then very briefly touch on some international issues. So first, just as background, I think everyone knows there's many HPV types. About 40 are sexually transmitted. There are high-risk types such as 16 and 18 that cause cervical and other anogenital cancers and a subset of oral cavity and oral pharyngeal cancers. And then there are low-risk types such as 6 and 11, which are responsible for most genital warts and also can cause a rare condition, recurrent respiratory papillomatosis. And this shows the percentage of cervical cancers attributed to different HPV types worldwide. And as you can see, 16 and 18 cause the vast majority, about 70%. And each of the other types, each are responsible for a smaller percentage. And this is, of course, the reason why the vaccine developers have focused on vaccines for HPV 16 and 18. There are two vaccines now licensed in the U.S., the quadrivalent vaccine, which is directed against two low-risk types, 6 and 11, and two high-risk types, 16 and 18, and the bivalent vaccine directed against 16 and 18. Both vaccines are given as three-dose series. The quadrivalent is produced by Merck. It was licensed in 2006 for females 9 to 26, and then just late last year in males 9 to 26. And the bivalent vaccine was licensed for females last year in females 10 to 25 years of age. Now, in the U.S., after a vaccine is licensed by the Food and Drug Administration, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP, considers a variety of data such as epidemiology, acceptability, program and implementation issues, and cost effectiveness before they make recommendations. And if a recommendation is made, the ACIP has authority to include a vaccine in the Vaccines for Children's program. Just very briefly about the Vaccines for Children's program. This program provides vaccine to eligible children who are less than 19 years of age, and I've listed the eligibility criteria. ACIP determines vaccines to be included in VFC by a vote, and no other legislation is needed. And after this, the federal government can establish a contract with the manufacturer, and then the government supplies vaccines to providers who are enrolled in the VFC program. And this is really the cornerstone of the vaccine financing system in this country. And in terms of childhood vaccines, about 50% of all vaccines are provided through VFC. Now, recommendations for HPV vaccine have been evolving in the U.S. In 2006, when the quadrivalent vaccine was licensed, it was recommended for routine vaccination of females 11 to 12 years of age and catch-up vaccination of females 13 through 26 years of age. And then, again, late last year, when the bivalent vaccine was licensed, it was given a similar recommendation. So now either vaccine are recommended for routine vaccination of 11 or 12-year-old females, and catch-up recommendations are the same. And the quadrivalent vaccine was also licensed in males, and a permissive recommendation was made, and I'm going to be discussing this more later in my talk. So how is the vaccination program doing in the United States? This slide here shows the estimated coverage with at least one dose of vaccine in 13 to 17-year-old females from the National Immunization Teen Survey in 2007 and 2008. 2007 was about a year after licensure, and coverage was about 25% overall, and very similar in all these age groups. And in 2008, this increased to 37%, and again, very similar in all the age groups. Now, this seems less than ideal, but I wanted to show you coverage for another adolescent vaccine, meningococcal conjugate vaccine, which is also recommended for 11 and 12-year-old girls. And you can see it's just slightly higher than HPV. This vaccine was licensed a little more than a year before HPV vaccine, so it had a year head start in a sense. But this is not that uncommon what we see for coverage in adolescents, because we don't have a school-based program. We expect children or adolescents to be immunized through their routine medical providers. Some other interesting selected findings from the National Immunization Survey is that initiation was higher among those below the poverty level and also higher among Hispanics and whites. And these findings are very likely, too, to the Vaccines for Children's program, which provides or facilitates access to low-income children and adolescents. And this is actually very encouraging. If we had seen disparities in uptakes with lower uptake in some racial groups or communities, this would be exacerbating existing disparities in cervical cancer in this country. Even though coverage was about 37% overall in the U.S., there are really striking differences by state. And this graph shows coverage by state in 2008. It ranged from a high of about 55% in some states in the Northeast to a low of about 16% in some states in the South. Now, not all of the reasons for this striking differences are known, but there are some interesting and creative financing arrangements that have been made by some states to facilitate vaccine accessibility. And this could be one of the reasons, but we don't really know all the reasons right now for these differences. Since licensure, a variety of surveys have been done and studies to look at provider and parent practices. And this study was a national survey of pediatricians done about 18 months after licensure, and it looks at recommendations by pediatricians. And you can see while about 98% of pediatricians were recommending the vaccine for the recommended age groups, that's 11 through 26-year-olds, there were differences in the strength of the recommendation. For 11 and 12-year-olds, only 56% were strongly recommending the vaccine, while for the older age groups, 89% or higher were recommending the vaccine. And so this is somewhat disturbing, since the recommended age group is the 11 to 12-year-olds. Also from the same study, which might shed some light on these differences in recommendations, were the most common reasons reported by pediatricians for vaccine refusal or deferral by a parent. And you can see that the most common reason was that the parent felt the vaccine was too new or hadn't been around long enough. But other reasons were related to age, the adolescent not being sexually active, 16%, and 13% thinking the adolescent was too young. Of course, this is of concern because we want to vaccinate before people are sexually active, and this really points to the need for more information and education of both providers and parents. Only 8% said they were concerned about safety, 7% said that insurance did not cover or the parent could not afford, and only 4% were concerned that vaccination might encourage sexual behavior. Now, I want to fast forward to the end of last year, 2009, and discuss some of the changes that occurred when the second vaccine was licensed, the bivalent vaccine, and that there was licensure of the quadrivalent vaccine for males. These changes brought a variety of new policy issues, new recommendations, and new challenges. So first I'm going to address the issue around having two licensed vaccines for use in females. Just a little bit about these two vaccines. They're both virus-like particle vaccines, or VLP vaccines, made from the L1 surface protein of the virus. I mentioned before that one vaccine has four types and the other has two types. They're both made using recombinant technology, and the producer cells are different for the two vaccines. The vaccines also have different adjuvants. The quadrivalent has an alum adjuvant, which is used in many vaccines that are licensed in the U.S., and the bivalent vaccine has ASO4, which is a new adjuvant. This is the first vaccine licensed in the U.S. with this adjuvant. AS04 was shown to enhance the immune response to the VLPs in early clinical trials. And both vaccines, as I said, are given as a three-dose schedule. Now, what does the clinical data show about these? First, both vaccines have very high efficacy against vaccine-type-related cervical cancer precursor lesions, cervical intraepithelial neoplasia grade 2 or higher. For the bivalent vaccine against type 16 or 18 related CIN2+, 93% efficacy with high efficacy individually against type 16 or 18. And for the quadrivalent, the efficacy was 98% with very high efficacy against the individual types when that was looked at. And so anyone who's been working in vaccines, this is really, really remarkable and striking high efficacy. For the quadrivalent vaccine, some additional endpoints were looked at. Vaginal and vulvar precancer lesions, VIN and VEIN, 100% efficacy against that endpoint, and vaccine type related genital warts or condyloma, a very high efficacy. Another thing that has been examined for both vaccines is cross protection, that is, protection against vaccine types that are not in HPV types that are not in the vaccine, and some data suggests that the vaccines may provide protection against high-risk types other than those in the vaccine. The types that have been examined are those that are phylogenetically related to HPV 16 and 18, and the data suggests that the bivalent may have more cross-protection than the quadrivalent, but direct comparisons are different because differences in the vaccine trial methods and assays used to detect different HPV types. This is a table I made to try to summarize some of our understanding about the two vaccines. First of all, in terms of protection against 16 or 18 related CIN2+, both very high efficacy and fairly similar. The quadrivalent also has demonstrated efficacy against vaginal and vulvar precancer lesions. Protection against genital warts related to vaccine types, of course, only for the quadrivalent vaccine. For cross-protection against precancer lesions due to high-risk types other than 16 or 18, the quadrivalent may have some protection against types that are related to 16, and the bivalent has more clear data related to protection against types related to 16 and possibly related to 18. Seroconversion is very high to both vaccines and higher than those produced by natural infection. The geometric mean titers after vaccination have been shown in a direct head-to-head comparison to be higher in the bivalent than the quadrivalent, but the meaning of this is unclear since both vaccines produce titers that are substantially higher than those after natural infection. In terms of duration of protection, both vaccines have shown good duration for the as long as the follow-up has been done, and there's no evidence of waning protection, and there's unclear if there's any, it's unclear if there's any difference between the two vaccines at this time. In terms of local reactogenicity, in the head-to-head trial that was done, the bivalent had a higher rate of local pain and swelling, but both vaccines have very good tolerability rates. And then in terms of the cost of the vaccine, we know the cost of the quadrivalent is about $130 in the private sector. The bivalent is reported to be $128. We have a contract, a federal contract for the quadrivalent vaccine, and the contract for the bivalent is currently being negotiated, so we don't know what that will be at the present time. So ACIP took a neutral approach to recommending these two vaccines, keeping the existing recommendation for routine and catch-up, and stating that vaccination with either the bivalent vaccine or the quadrivalent vaccine could be used for prevention of cervical cancers or precancers, and vaccination with the quadrivalent vaccine should be done for prevention of cervical cancers, precancers, and genital warts. Of course, this neutral approach leaves the decision up to providers, purchasers of the vaccine, and parents, and there will be challenges in communicating the differences of the vaccines and understanding for all of these sectors. Now, what about males? I don't have to tell this group that HPV is also a problem in males. Males have a similar prevalence of infection as females, and the burden of diseases and cancers in males include genital warts, recurrent respiratory papillomatosis, and a variety of cancers. and transmission is high between sex partners. And we also know that men who have sex with men have a greater burden of HPV-related outcomes. Anal cancer, for example, while the rate in the general population of males is about 2 per 100,000, it's about 35 per 100,000 MSM, and even higher in those who are HIV positive. The slide shows the cancers that are associated with HPV in both women and men. And while HPV does cause cancers in women and men, we can see here that the burden of cancers is substantially higher in women compared to men, about 17,000 annually in women compared to about 7,000 in men. The study from the quadrivalent vaccine efficacy trial in men is the data are now available. This was a study that included about 3,000 heterosexual men and about 600 men who have sex with men. And the primary objective was efficacy against vaccine type-related external genital warts and a variety of other external genital lesions. And that was endpoints included heterosexual and men who have sex with men. And then a sub-study was done in MSM, and the endpoint in this study was anal precancer and cancers. These are the data that were available last year from the male study showing an efficacy of about 89% against genital warts. And these data were available to the FDA last year, and they, based on these data, they licensed the vaccine for use in males 9 through 26 for prevention specifically of 6 and 11 related genital warts, since the data from the other studies were not available. And these are also the data that were available to ACIP in October when they made their decision. Now, when considering recommendation for males, as for all vaccines, vaccine efficacy, epidemiology and burden of disease, program issues, and cost effectiveness were taken into consideration. And a lot of models have now been done looking at cost effectiveness of male vaccination, and these have shown that vaccination is most cost effective when coverage among females is low, because then there's more opportunity for herd immunity, and men are not protected from the high coverage in women when all potential health outcomes are included in the model and when vaccine efficacy is high. This is one model that the ACIP looked at that looks at cost-effectiveness ratios for male vaccination and emphasizes the impact of different disease outcomes that are included in the model. You can see on the left-hand side are the bars for vaccination of girls only, and on the right are the bars for vaccination of including males in the program. And again, the lower the bar, the more cost-effective is the strategy. In the light blue are strategies that are only looking at prevention of cervical cancer, and in the green bars are the bars looking at cost-effectiveness if all potential outcomes of HPV are included. And I guess one of the things you can see here is that even with all outcomes included, these vaccines, the vaccination of male, did not fall below the threshold normally considered cost-effective in the U.S., which is below 50 to 100,000. Now, the important thing here to notice is that these models include coverage of about 75% in females and males, and our coverage in the U.S. is much lower than this. And if one included in the model coverage in the U.S. at the present time, vaccination of males would look much more favorable. The discussions in October at the ACIP meeting focused on the programmatic challenges at the state and local level, mainly around financing for these expensive vaccines, that the burden of disease and cancers was primarily in female, and that cost-effectiveness studies demonstrated the additional costs would for adding male vaccination and potentially relatively minimal benefits. They felt the priority should be given to vaccinating females to reduce the overall burden of disease and cancers, but the outstanding information for future consideration was efficacy data from the trial looking at precancer lesions and cost-effectiveness in MSM, and of course, vaccine price. If the price is lower, then all these cost-effectiveness analyses change. The resolution in October, the ACIP recommendation and VFC resolution in October was that HPV vaccine may be given to males 9 through 26 to reduce their likelihood of acquiring genital warts. This is a permissive recommendation. It's not included in the routine schedule, but it's basically acknowledging the vaccine is licensed, and it's a permissive recommendation. Interestingly, the ACIP also voted to include the vaccine in the Vaccines for Children's program, which is often reserved for a routine recommendation. This enables VFC providers to provide vaccine at no cost to eligible males who are 9 to 18 years of age. Now, soon after October, data now became available from the sub-study in men who have sex with men, looking at prevention of vaccine-type-related anal intraepithelial neoplasia. And these data, which have now been presented publicly and also to ACIP, shows that there was a 98% efficacy for any grade AIN, and I'm sorry, 78% efficacy, and a 75% efficacy for high-grade AIN lesions. So these are the first data really available to look at prevention of cancer endpoints in males. And these data have now been submitted to FDA for review. Further considerations of vaccine for males will be undertaken. These will include looking at the vaccine efficacy data, which I just showed you, looking at cost-effectiveness analyses with different efficacy and coverage assumptions, also looking at program issues. There are some people that have proposed that having a gender-neutral recommendation will facilitate uptake in both genders, looking at equity issues, epidemiology and cost-effectiveness of HPV in men who have sex with men, and also this important issue of what is the feasibility of reaching MSM when they would most benefit from vaccination. Another issue that's upcoming in 2010 is whether or not HPV vaccine should be used in women over the age of 26. Now, the efficacy data are available from a trial in women 24 to 45, and the data have already been submitted to FDA. And this study showed high efficacy against a combined endpoint of persistent infection, external genital lesions, and CIN due to vaccine types. It's important to remember when considering this age group that there'll be a relatively small impact of vaccination in adult women, and this is because the incidence of new infections decreases as women get older, and also the percent of women who've already been infected will increase. And it's true that some women may benefit from vaccination in this age group, models show that there's a potential for very high cost per quality in this age range. And I wanted to show this graph from a study that was published a few years ago looking at 12 to 26-year-olds, looking at cost-effectiveness by age and looking at different health conditions. And the different color lines, again, include the cost-effectiveness, looking at cervical cancer only versus all the other outcomes that are related to HPV. And you can see the increase with increasing age included in the vaccination program, and this would just continue to increase and clearly be above 100,000 in some of the older age groups. So getting back to our ACIP recommendations, again, these are evolving. We just had a change at the end of 2009 when the second vaccine was included in the recommendations for females and a permissive recommendation was made for males. And it's likely in 2010 when ACIP reviews other data that there'll be additional changes to the recommendations. I want to end this talk talking about cervical cancer worldwide. Clearly, there are differences in cervical cancer in different parts of the world, and the countries in red and pink on this graph have the highest rates of cervical cancer and are clearly the countries that could benefit most from HPV vaccine. What's happening internationally with HPV vaccine? Well, in 2008, the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunizations agreed to prioritize HPV vaccine as well as other new vaccines, but there's no funding yet, and so there's no vaccine actually available to low-income countries. The World Health Organization recommended vaccine for national immunization programs in 2009 if a variety of conditions were met, including it was a public health priority, introduction was feasible, and the cost effectiveness had been considered. Both vaccines are now pre-qualified by the World Health Organization, and this means that UNICEF and other international groups can procure the vaccine. And the vaccines are licensed in over 100 countries, but implementation is very limited outside of Europe, North America, and Australia. And cost is the major barrier, of course, for implementation of the vaccine in low resource settings. So in summary, just want to say that progress is being made with vaccine implementation in the U.S. Further efforts, of course, are needed to increase uptake. The two vaccines are available in the U.S. for females, and this is beneficial for competition and supply, and maybe the vaccine price will come down with two manufacturers now in the market. But there will also be changes related to different attributes of the vaccine, decisions and communications that have to be made regarding those. There's a permissive recommendation for the vaccine for males, and it's been included in the Vaccines for Children's program. And issues that need to be addressed in the next year include vaccines for males, again, considering the new data that's now available, and HPV vaccine for women over age 26. And, of course, implementation of HPV vaccine internationally is challenging, and there'll have to be continued efforts to move forward in that arena as well. Thank you. And I also want to thank a variety of people on my work group.
Thank you, Dr. Marquis, for a comprehensive and very interesting presentation. We have time for just a couple of minutes of questions from people in the audience. Please, go right ahead. It's not on there.
Thank you.
My question is whether the aid that is considered by the sense of clinical universality, and we work with HPV vaccine in terms of considering male immunization, and also the fact that we're at a certain portion of the shade of lying through, where it takes 40 minutes, what is realistic.
Well, this was a major issue, and both of those were major issues. First of all, the coverage, there are differences of opinion. Some people feel, well, we eventually will get up there. It just takes time since we don't have school-based programs where we can go in and get really high coverage immediately. So some people really felt we are going to get there. Other people feel we're not. And so that was a big debate, and I think there's people on both sides of that. And the universality issue was definitely raised. And this is an iterative process, and ACIP will continue to discuss these, but both of those issues were definitely taken into consideration.
Mary.
Yeah. And I think, again, that's really been discussed extensively at the WHO level, understanding the difficulty in reaching adolescents in any country, really. I think people want to see more data on duration of protection before going there. And there have been discussions about studies, and maybe not infants right now, but at least even going down to five-year-olds and looking at young school-age children. So there are discussions, and I think even by the manufacturers, there have been discussions about that. So the question is, do we think that there will be replacement? Yeah, and this is, there are for other vaccines like pneumococcal vaccines that are not directed against all of types. There has been replacement seen. People have been discussing this. They don't think it's going to be the same for HPV vaccine because of the biology of it, and the way the niches are formed. But there are studies that have been set up to be able to look at this, both in the U.S. as well as in Scandinavia. There's some very large studies in the Nordic cancer registries that are being set up to look at some of these things.
And the last question.
Yeah, that's just initiation, so it's at least one dose. And so coverage with three doses was below that. It was in the I don't have the number with me, but it was about maybe in the low 20s for, or even in the high teens for completion. But for the National Immunization Survey, when they survey people, they actually don't know if they've had enough time to complete that three-dose series, so it could be artificially low. But there are data from a variety of other local studies that have been done in specific locations looking at completion rates. And so some of them have been actually quite good that have been done in health maintenance organizations, and others have been quite low. So it is a challenge to get three doses into adolescents. It's challenging to get them in at all, and it's challenging to get three doses in. Maybe someone has some data here.
Okay. Quickly.
Well, there's a study going on in India looking at a 2-versus-3-dose schedule right now, and there have been looking at efficacy endpoints, and people obviously want to look at efficacy endpoints. So people are starting to look at that and talk about that. And in the U.S., we're in a different situation where when FDA licenses a vaccine for a certain number of doses, it's sometimes hard for people to use fewer number of doses in the U.S. Other countries have done that, and we haven't done that as much here.
Thank you very much, Dr. Markowitz, and all three of the speakers.